from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Happy Halloween!
Ooh.
Nothing too scary on our show today. I'll take a look at what Beef and Boards is up to.
I'll meet the author of a new novel called Short Girls.
And I'll take a closer look at the book chosen for this year's One Book, One City. And there's our arts calendar events we call
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. In its 36th year, Beef and Boards continues to serve up fun, food, and fabulous entertainment. Travis DiNicola spoke with Beef and Boards' Eddie Curry about what they have on the menu for the coming season.
We're going to be talking about Beef and Boards, but you're also in Shipwrecked over at the Phoenix right now, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. I keep hearing great things about it.
We're having a great time over there. It's a fun show.
Good, good. Well, let's jump from the Phoenix to Beef and Boards. Not jumping ship or Shipwrecked, but Beef and Boards is 35 years.
Actually, I think it's one more than that. I think it's 36 years.
Wow.
This is the 36th season that we're wrapping up,
okay,
getting ready to go into the 37th. The building was built in 1973,
wow,
and that was right as the 465 loop was being built.
Yeah.
And a gentleman who was involved in highway construction built several dinner theaters, and with in mind that traffic would be good for it.
Mm-hmm.
He only guest ride on the Indianapolis location. And
so there were some other ones at
the
time.
And the current owner owned three of them at one point in time, one in Simpsonville, Kentucky, and mm-hmm. one in Harris, Cincinnati area of
okay.
Ohio, Harrison, I believe. And they closed those two to focus their efforts on the Indianapolis location.
Was there one in Evansville, too?
Not that I know
okay.
of, but I'm not going to say for yeah. certain there wasn't.
But so now for 37 years, serving up a menu of theater and food with some great shows. I know right now you've got Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat coming up. Tell me a bit about what you've got coming up for the immediate the holidays, and then we'll take a look at the 2010 season.
Well, every holiday season we offer two annual shows, the first of which is our self-titled A Beef and Boards Christmas, which
mm-hmm.
this year is in its 17th annual production.
Big and, review.
It is a big review, much like you might see with New York, in New York with
mm-hmm.
the Radio City Music Hall show, featuring some fabulous voices and great dancing, spectacular costumes. Then we also do a one-hour matinee version of the Charles Dickens classic, A Christmas Carol.
Okay.
And this year I get to play Scrooge again, which my wife says is typecasting. And joining me on stage will be a local news anchor person, Tricia Shepherd from WRTV6.
Oh,
she's going to be playing the ghost of Christmas Past, so we're
excellent.
Excited to have her in the show. So that's what we have for the holidays. Joseph's on stage through November 22nd.
Okay.
And for the next several weekends for the kids, Jack and the Beanstalk is on stage.
That's right. You do a lot of productions for families and for kids as well.
We try and do one every summer that is appropriate for all ages, without a doubt. Next season we have an exciting one, and we always do a one-hour children's show, one in the fall and one in the spring.
Now, do all the shows come with food or no?
That's a really good question. All of the main stage shows come with
mm-hmm.
with a meal. The only shows that don't come with a meal are our Pyramid Players productions, which are the shows for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they get a Rice Krispie
Pyramid, because you're right next to the pyramids.
Right to the pyramids.
There.
I
yeah.
thought that was a
there
creative
okay.
name several years ago when we started.
Mm-hmm.
But they get a Rice Krispie treat and a box of juice on the table when they come in.
Okay.
So they still get the idea that
yeah.
when you go to Beef and Boards, it's kind of two experiences wrapped up into one big
mm-hmm.
event.
Okay. It's sort of for the kids more like snack theater.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about the food. Is it a big buffet?
Big Buffet. It's made right there on site by Chef Odell Ward, and he's been there for at least 25 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much more than that, but has been with the business a long time, as a lot of the staff have at Beef and Boards, because it's a big family up there. The owner, mm-hmm. Doug Stark, has put together a good group of people that he's counted on for a number of years. And the doors open at 6, and then a buffet-style dinner serves from 6:30 to 7:30 throughout the evening. You get cocktail service at your table and
excellent
and gourmet desserts. Mm-hmm. So it's like I said, two experiences wrapped up into one fun event.
Right, and you don't have to worry about finishing up dinner, so you can catch the show down the street.
You know what? One of the biggest benefits really is free parking.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to any of the other theaters in town, and God love them, they're doing great shows. I'm a big supporter of all of them. But it's hard to find a place to park.
It can be.
At Beef and Boards. We got plenty of place to park.
Good to keep in mind. Now, for the 2010 season, you've got, of course, a lot of musicals, but also also some other plays as well. You're starting the season with the comedy The Foreigner.
Larry Hsu.
Yeah.
He has another comedy called The Nerd that is set in Terre Haute. So this is a gentleman who gets Midwest and Southern type humor. And The Foreigner, the word that comes to mind for it is deception, because there's deception on a lot of different levels in that show, which equate into a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Beef and Board's regular Jeff Stockburger will be playing The Foreigner. So okay. Right there, you know, there's going to be plenty of laughs in that show.
Yeah, definitely.
And I get the honor of directing it.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Very good. Yeah, that's a very fun show to kick off your season. Walk me through the rest of it, if you would.
The rest of them are mainly musicals or shows that feature music. Footloose, which was, you know, the huge 1980s mega movie hit with Kevin Bacon featuring Holding Out for a Hero, Let's Hear It for the Boy, mm-hmm. Almost Paradise, and, of course, Footloose. That's the second show in our season. But not only is it that fun music and dancing, but it's also a great story to follow. Then the classic Hello Dolly with the Jerry Herman classic score. Yonkers will never be the same again after Doug Stark takes the stage mm-hmm. as Horace Vandegelder in Hello Dolly. The next one is a show that I think is going to be the sleeper hit of the summer, and it's Always Patsy Cline. It's two women, five musicians, and 27 of Patsy Cline's hits
great
in
music.
This show.
Yeah.
And the musicians are five of our, or three of our folks out of the five are from our past three summers of Smoke on the Mountain.
Okay.
Those fabulous musicians. Then, of course, our family musical next summer is Disney's High School Musical. And, the Next Generation's Grease, Church Basement Ladies, Camelot, and White Christmas. Church Basement Ladies, very funny show about ladies who run a church basement kitchen. Of course, Camelot, the classic King mm-hmm. and Castles, Love and Loss, Beauty and Betrayal. And then, for the first time ever on the Beef and Board stage, White Christmas.
White Christmas.
That's our 2010 season. It's a
nice.
Lot.
Yeah.
We usually only do seven shows plus our Christmas show. This is eight shows plus our Christmas show. So it's a big season for us in 2010.
Now, tell me about where you get your talent from. Is there sort of a general roster of artists that tend to work with you guys a lot, or you also have auditions on a fairly regular basis?
It's a little bit of all of that. I could just say yes
yeah.
and answer that question. But it is a good question, because not only do we pull from people that we know who we consider to be members of our family, you want to work with those people because they've showed loyalty to you in the past,
mm-hmm.
and it's only right that you show loyalty to them. We also want to work with more local talent if possible. Of course, our schedule is different because we rehearse during the days, so it makes it a little difficult for some of the great talent that this city has
sure.
to be available to us for our productions. We hold a local audition every year. We also go to Chicago occasionally, and I go into New York with Doug Stark and Ron Morgan or Doug King, our choreographers. We go into New York 2-3 times a year,
mm-hmm.
and we get a lot of good upcoming talent there. And you know what? We've been sending some talent to New York recently. Kara Oates, who was our Annie this past summer in Annie,
mm-hmm.
She met a fellow while she was here who was in our production of Treasure Island. He went back to New York, said to his agent, you got to meet this girl. She went in, auditioned for the agent. The agent had her come back, audition for Billy Elliot. Long story short,
oh, wow.
She's been in Billy Elliot for over a month now.
Nice.
So it's kind of fun that Beef and Boards is give and take with New York a lot.
And just to be clear, you guys are a professional theater.
Absolutely.
Using professional actors and dancers and singers.
And not only do we pay the actors, mm-hmm. but we're also affiliated with the Actors Union, which is Actors Equity Association.
Excellent. Now, I'm sure that there's a lot of people, especially when they hear that you're doing High School Musical, a lot of kids in town that are thinking, I want to be in that. Are you going to have auditions for that?
Because of 8 shows a week
mm-hmm.
and it being such a long run, I will probably go more with the 90210 approach to the show, where I will cast college-age kids mm-hmm. who are a little more used to that
sure.
type of grind. There's a big difference when you go from high school to college
mm-hmm.
and a full year is compressed into a semester. It's sort of the same way when you work at a theater that goes as quickly as we do. We rehearse our shows 10 to 12 days,
mm-hmm.
and then it's up.
Well, that's
pretty
fast.
Whereas some people are used to, you know, 7 weeks in college
right.
and high school. Other professional theaters will take, you know, maybe 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
but they work a little bit more slowly and methodically on a Shakespeare piece than you're going to on Jerry Herman. Hello, Dolly,
sure.
for instance.
Tell me a little bit more about the Pyramid Players, because that is the youth group that you have, or for performances for kids.
Exactly. It's a wonderful program. It's hugely popular. The ticket prices are low, so it's affordable for mom or grandpa and grandma to bring the kids to the show. Like I said, they get a box of juice and a Rice Krispie treat on the table when they come in. And not only do they get to see a great show, but I think the most popular aspect of that troupe is that after every show, they line up in the lobby so that the kids have a chance to touch their imagination and meet their imagination. And so the characters are out there signing autographs and getting their pictures
nice.
Taken with
That's
the
great.
Kids. But, you know, we didn't have anything that fit that bill.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug Stark and at the time his partner Bob Zare charged me with the responsibility of, hey, we want to start a children's theater program and you're in charge of it, make it happen. And through their guidance and leadership, we started that in 1994 and I believe produced our first show in 95.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, Eddie, it's a real pleasure chatting with you. And of course, theater tickets make a great holiday gift.
They do.
And especially with your two holiday shows coming up, people can always get more information at beefandboards.com and check you guys out for an entire evening of entertainment and
Absolutely.
Food.
Absolutely. All right there at one lovely spot on the northwest side.
Travis DiNicola with Eddie Curry from Beef and Boards. For the complete Beef and Boards Dinner Theater schedule, visit, you guessed it, beefandboards.com. And is spelled out, beefandboards.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Bik Minh Nguyen is a creative writing professor at Purdue University. Her 2007 book, Stealing Buddha's Dinner, was a memoir about growing up as a child of Vietnamese immigrants in the American heartland. Her new book, Short Girls, is a funny and touching novel about two Vietnamese-American daughters trying to achieve personal and professional stature in Detroit and Chicago. Sharon Gamble talked with Bik about Short Girls and the difference between writing memoirs and novels. Bick began with a reading from Short Girls.
After Van had left for college, her parents decided to live on separate floors of the house they'd had for 20 years, a 60s ranch in Wrightville, a suburb in West Michigan. They'd fallen into the arrangement after yet another petty argument blew up into a two-day fight. The Lungs had always done this, scratching at each other's words as much out of habit as anything. But this time, when Thuy Lung told her husband to go sleep in the basement like a dog, he stayed there instead of slinking back upstairs. When Van went home for winter break, she found that he had actually moved to the basement. He had shoved aside the old fold-out sofa they'd had since their first apartment and set up a futon right in front of the big screen TV, a clunky first-generation model that would soon be replaced by newer and newer ones, to which he would add an elaborate sound system with speakers hidden inside wooden figurines of Vietnamese fishermen. The basement had always been his domain. Van was going on 9 when they moved into that house, and she had helped him partition off a section of the floor to create a studio for his company, Lung Inventions by Din Lung, for which he often ditched his jobs in tiling and construction. He kept his sketches tacked up on the faux wood paneling, along with photographs of himself trying out his prototypes. His most successful invention, or least unsuccessful, was the Lung Arm, a tong-like gadget devised to help short people reach items on a high shelf. He had sold more than 100 Lung Arms to various friends in the Vietnamese community, but the product had never been quite right. The mechanical grip could grab a light basket, but lost control with plates and glasses. When Van graduated from college, her father gave her a prototype as a gift, saying, "Short girls have to take care of themselves."
And so we have a sense of where the title comes from, Short Girls. You know, this is a beautiful family story, but it's also a story in many regards about separation, about otherness, about being banished to a basement, effectively. And, of course, I'm sure everybody asks you this, but it's such a natural question. Do you have a sense of otherness having grown up in the Midwest in a Vietnamese-American family?
Well, I did grow up feeling a kind of otherness, mostly because I grew up in the late 70s and early to mid-1980s, which was a time before a lot of thinking about diversity and multiculturalism. So it was a fun time to grow up, the 80s, but at the same time, there was not as much of the progressive thinking we have today. So I did feel often like an outsider. And I write about that in my first book, Stealing Buddha's Dinner. But all of that outsiderness definitely helped me to become a writer. So I don't have a lot of regrets about it.
That's great to seize the golden lining there in the dark cloud. Yeah. Do you have a sister?
I have two sisters, yes. And I'm really close to them. And so the sisters in this novel, Short Girls, are not based on my actual sisters or my relationship with them.
But, which, you know, is probably good.
It's good. But, you know, I do know the sort of push and pull of sister relationships, how you can love and hate each other at the same time.
Sure, sure. It's wonderful, the story arc, and I'm trying to figure out how we can talk about this without giving too much away. But Linny and Van are sisters who don't really feel as though they belong in the same family in some ways, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they are a little bit like oil and water, and one is the social one and the other is the academic one or the brainy one.
Right. And I found this to be true in a lot of families and my own too, that sometimes one sibling is considered to be the pretty one and the other sibling is considered to be the smart one, and therefore they grow up feeling sort of opposite. And so I took that to more of an extreme with Linny and Van as sisters, and gave them this conflict that they feel that they don't really know each other because they grew up feeling so different, you know, growing up in different spheres. And through the novel, they have to sort of figure out who they are, you know, as individuals and who they are as sisters.
And it turns out that actually the brainy one is more social than she even knows, and the social one is smarter than she knows.
Right. Yeah. As is often the case, people who seem to have so many differences find out that they have much more in common than they ever imagined.
You know, they have a they have the same parents, they grew up with the same parents, and yet they have rather different experiences of their late mother and their father, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they these two sisters are very close in age, but because their identities were shaped as, you know, the pretty one and the smart one, their relationships with their parents were very different. And so they carry that with them through their lives. And I was really interested in exploring that, how, you know, relationships can be so cemented in childhood and adolescence. And then, you know, we can spend the rest of our adult years, you know, figuring them out.
And trying to get away from them in a way, too.
Mm-hmm. Resolve them.
Yeah. Now, both of these lovely young women think they maybe have found the right romantic partner, but that becomes not nearly as secure as they hope.
Right. I'm really interested in writing about and reading about bad relationships.
Well, you can learn more from bad ones than good ones in a way, right?
I mean, I always tell my students, you know, everyone wants to hear the breakup story, but the getting together story is just not as interesting.
One of the great Russian writers, help me here, Miss Professor Lady, said happy families are all alike, but unhappy families are all unique.
Also, right.
Yeah, there we go.
So,
and it's so true. It's more interesting.
True. It's all about conflict.
Yeah, yeah. Is there a sense in which you were hoping for a happy romantic outcome for these two sisters, in that symbolizes assimilation or homogenization in some way?
Well, you know, the whole idea of assimilation is very tricky, and I wanted to sort of explore the pros and cons, I guess, of assimilation and the idea behind it as it's connected to immigration in that novel. And as much as it, you know, I do want the characters to have, you know, happy endings, it's never going to be that simple, unfortunately. And so this is a really weird part about writing a novel, which is very different from writing nonfiction. You become sort of invested in your characters, and you may want something for them that they can't have in terms of the arc of the narrative.
At what point do they start talking to you? Do your characters talk to you? And, I mean, give us some insight into your process. Do they knock on your door and say, here, write about me, there's something you need to know about me? Or do you start out more conceptually, and then do they take on a life of their own a few pages, a few chapters in?
You know, for me, they really took on lives of their own. And before I ever wrote a novel, I used to think, oh, this is impossible. It's crazy that, you know, you could write characters and suddenly they would seem real to you, like imaginary friends. But it actually does happen that I would begin to think about Linny and Van while walking around. And I began to think about them so much, I would sometimes almost think they were real. And it would seem as though their personalities would develop on the page as I was typing them. It was such a strange and sort of wonderful feeling.
Kind of otherworldly.
Yes.
That's
one of the fun
cool
parts about writing.
Yeah. Did you, your first book was a memoir. It was about your own childhood, your own life growing up. Is there a way in which, and since we know you teach the craft of writing, this feels like a reasonable question to ask. I don't want you to give away trade secrets or anything, but is there a way in which you prepare yourself to write differently when you're writing fiction as opposed to nonfiction?
Oh, yes. And, you know, this is something I talk about a lot with students, and it's a subject that's really interesting to me, that the relationship between writing fiction and nonfiction. I think there's a way in which one can inform the other. You know, and when you're writing nonfiction, you can use the techniques of narrative craft that you use in fiction. And you can explore things in nonfiction that you can't in fiction. You know, sometimes you hear, this is too true for fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot, in which case, write it in nonfiction. Hmm. Or, you know, you're thinking about a memory, you can't remember it fully, just a little bit of it, write it in fiction. So I think there are ways to think about how material can be, you know, channeled into one genre over another.
In writing nonfiction, were you ever tempted to fictionalize your own life a little bit?
in the book itself, in the nonfiction book? Mm-hmm. No. That really violates the whole point of writing nonfiction.
Sure.
So I think it's really important to stick to the memories that you have, but also, you know, what I always tell my students, it's not just what you can remember, it's what you can't forget.
Oh. Those are two very different things, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. And it's really the unforgettable. That's really what is the focal point.
Do you have a preference for one style of writing over the other?
No, I love both the genres. I'm an equal opportunity reader.
Very good. And I hope some of your students will hear this and know that you practice what you preach in the classroom. Any chance that there might be a sequel someday? I have to say that I have a bad habit when reading a book I really love. I slow down as I'm getting towards the end because I don't want it to be over.
Me too. I always do that.
So I want to know. And maybe it's best if you don't tell us what happens to Linny and Van 5, 10, 15 years later. But are you tempted?
I'm not sure, although I will say that I love sequels. In general, mm-hmm. sequels to books, to movies, just the idea of getting to know characters a few years in the future is just so tantalizing. So, maybe.
Sharon Gamble with Bik Minh Nguyen, author of the 2007 memoir Stealing Buddha's Dinner and the brand new novel Short Girls. Bik teaches writing at Purdue University. The novel is available at Broad Ripple's Big Hat Books and many other bookstores.
Travis, you're scaring me. What's going on over there?
I'm just getting ready for some more mummy jokes. Sharon, you're
not
going
to
believe this.
Oh, no.
I actually ran into an Art of the Matter fan who I will not name. I don't want to embarrass her. Last week who said, I love the mummy jokes. And so we had so much fun doing those a couple weeks ago. I had to ask you, do you think mummies enjoy being mummies?
Of course they do. I thought you were going to say they got all wrapped up in it.
Oh, that's nice. What about, do you know who the best mummy wrapper is in Egypt?
No, I haven't a clue.
The Wizard of Gauze.
Okay. more, please.
Oh, goodness. Okay, well, just one more, because this one actually is still my favorite.
Uh-oh.
What did the sign say in the Egyptian funeral home?
I don't know.
Satisfaction guaranteed, or your mummy back. Of course, all the mummies were listening to rap music.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay, what 5-year-old did you steal these jokes from, Travis? Out there. He's outside the studio window saying, I want my jokes back.
I didn't get any candy in my trick-or-treat basket this year. I just got a whole bunch of mummy jokes. So, and a few suggestions of some arts events to go to that we'll talk about.
What? We're actually doing this?
Here we go on
What'll We Boo?
Wow.
Oh, dear.
Yeah,
well,
it's been a long October.
Okay, so it has been a long October. It's almost over, though. So... that means you have but a few scant hours to still go to look for the lost mummy at Tomb of Doom. Quest for the... I don't have the right voice for it. You have to do this one. Quest for the Lost Mummy. What is that? Well, of course, it is the annual haunted house at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. So go soon.
Hey, a really fun play that's going on this weekend is Shipwreck at the Phoenix Theater. And it is an entertainment for the entire family. That's right, at the Phoenix, and sort of an old-fashioned adventure story told by some great actors, including Eddie Curry, who was just on, talking about Beef and Boards a little bit earlier, but check out Shipwrecked at the Phoenix.
Speaking of on stage, right now, just opening this weekend at Indianapolis Civic Theater is The Elephant Man, the Tony Award-winning drama by Bernard Pomerantz. If you've never seen this moving story about a man's struggles with the physical things that set him apart, you really should go, and you can take your children too, especially junior high and high school age kids will appreciate this story of how everybody has something that sets him or her apart. The Elephant Man on stage right now at Indianapolis Civic Theater, playing through November 15th.
There's a mesmerizing concert going on this weekend at the ISO. featuring some really fun music as well as some magicians. I don't know if you heard about this, Sharon, but the group that does Quick Change is going to be performing as well as some other magicians at the ISO. Very fun family Halloween sort of concert there.
Absolutely. Love that. Well, I have something that has just opened on stage at the Indiana Repertory Theater that is not scary, but is something that a lot of kids love. There's a book called The Giver, and it's been adapted into a stage play, which is on stage at the Indiana Repertory Theater right now. It's a trip into the utopian, seemingly utopian world of 12-year-old Jonas, who's chosen to hold the community's long-forgotten memories of joy and pain and pass them along. So that's going on at the IRT right now.
And there's a lot of stuff that's going to be going on with Spirit and Place coming up. It runs from November 6th to 15th. It's actually the 14th year for the festival. And this year it's sort of a leaner, streamlined Spirit and Chase. 10 days with not quite such an overwhelming schedule, but more of a tightened schedule. Though there's still more than 40 events. 85% of them are free.
Wow, free is good.
Cool. And really the best thing to do is to check out the Spirit and Place website. They also have a Facebook fan book page as well. But to get the whole schedule, there's almost too much to try to go into. But there's a lot of interesting music and theater and conversational events for all ages taking place this year as part of Spirit in Place. One thing I do want to mention is that next Saturday morning, the 7th, is the Spirited Chase, which is a WFYI event.
Right.
That is going to be a lot of fun. From a whole bunch of submissions, FYI has actually selected 6 inspiring places. And they're doing sort of a road rally, not a race, but a rally to encourage people to discover some of the most interesting places in town. The places are going to be a surprise until you actually participate in the Spirited Chase next Saturday morning. And travel expert and NPR commentator Rudy Maxa is going to be there, as well as Dick Wolfsey. And in fact, I'm going to drop by for a little bit in the morning to kick things off,
I think. Excellent.
Yeah, so it takes place, starts at WFYI Studios, actually, next Saturday morning from 9 a.m. It'll go till 4 p.m.
Very
you can still
good.
Register, and you do need to register for this event if you go to fyi.org/spiritedchase.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Hey, don't forget the Day of the Dead celebration at the Indianapolis Arts Center from noon to 5 this coming Sunday. That's November 1st. But the Altar exhibition will still be up through November 7th. So if you haven't had a chance to get to the Indianapolis Arts Center to see the amazing altars created by local artists as well as by families and community groups, you have one more week to do that.
And it's time to start marking your Saturday nights out for the Naptown Roller Girls. Their season 4 opener is coming up on Saturday, November 7th at 5 p.m. And for their opener, they're going to be at the Pepsi Coliseum at the State Fairgrounds. This is a pretty big deal. The actual bout is a little bit later that evening, but doors open at 5 p.m. And it's a doubleheader, in fact. They're having the Naptown Roller Girls as well as sort of the veteran Tornado Sirens, as well as the junior varsity Warning Bells, will both be competing. So it'll be a lot
name,
of fun.
The Warning Bells?
The Warning Bells.
I love that.
You know, if you're not a fan, if you've never been to Roller Derby, this is the year. It's some of the best entertainment in town.
Okay. Hey, the Central Library here in Indianapolis is the place to be next Saturday. That's November 7th. There's all sorts of cool stuff going on, including a workshop for teens in building Frida shrines. Shrines celebrating the life and work of artist Frida Kahlo. Also going on at Central Library next Saturday is a Family Fall Fest Lecture and Slam and Rhymes Challenge 4. That's a long title. I think Family Fall Fest for short. From 1 to 5, you can hear the Mount Olive Choir, the Indie Steppers, Metropolitan Youth Orchestra, Poetry Slam performances, and book signings all going on at Central Library. That's all going on next Saturday.
There you go. Last thing I've got is at the Christopher West Presents, the gallery down on Mass Avenue. That's part of Dean Johnson. The first, the inaugural exhibit for Christopher West exists. Christopher West Presents, the Danielle Reedy installation closes on Halloween. The new exhibit actually opens up Thursday night, and it's titled Women, New Work by Craig Doty, and he is a photographer from Chicago who has shown his work all around the world, and this will be his first Indianapolis exhibit. And then also, of course, next Friday night, there's tons of openings for First Friday.
Excellent.
Whoa.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, we will be back with more not-so-scary things next week on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Mystery is in the air in Indianapolis, and that's not just because BoucherCon, the world's largest convention of mystery fans and writers, was just here. One of the legacies of the BoucherCon is its relationship to the city's One Book, One City program, which has been brought back to celebrate the works of mystery author Rex Stout, who was born in Noblesville. Stout's book, One Buried Caesar, is this year's One Book, One City selection. Our own mystery maven, Travis DiNicola, spoke with Melanie Whistle, a program manager from the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library, about the book and the events surrounding it this year.
One of the really cool legacies, I think, of having BoucherCon here is the way that it was connected by the library and the mayor's office to bringing back One Book, One City. Tell me a bit about
this. Yes. Well, Indianapolis was quite honored to be able to host BoucherCon this year, the otherwise known as the world's largest mystery conference and of mystery fans and readers. And so we adopted that wholeheartedly at the library and turned October into an entire month of mystery with different programs. Especially, it was wonderful to be able to have so many mystery authors in town. It gave the library an opportunity to host programs with authors that the community otherwise would not have an opportunity to hear. So that is all past now, but another benefit of BoucherCon for us was the opportunity to focus on a mystery this year for One Book, One City. So the theme was, what would all of Indianapolis do if they read a mystery?
And here we go with the Nero Wolfe mystery, Some Buried Caesar. But taking a step back, One Book, One City is a program that had been around for a while and then was sort of on hiatus a little bit.
That is true. One Book, One City actually started in Seattle with a librarian named Nancy Pearl, and then it has it's a wonderful way for communities to build a community of readers as an initiative, and so it kind of spread across the country and has been adopted by many different cities. And so we're not the only city to offer One Book, One
City.
Sort of
like making the whole city a book club. And
exactly so.
Now, in the past, the books had been selected, did seem to have, well, I believe the first one, I'm forgetting the name of it, but it was
The Friendly Persuasion.
Thank you, Friendly Persuasion, which had many Indiana connections to it, and that's certainly a bonus. And now that that we have One Book, One City back, the connection with having Rex Stout is not just that BoucherCon was held here, but some people who are fans of Rex Stout may know that he was actually born in Noblesville.
That's correct. Yeah. And Nancy Pearl suggests that one good idea is to select a book with particular meaning to a community, and so we felt that Rex Stout would be a great introduction to mysteries, and plus he had this wonderful connection to Indiana. I mean, who knew when you think about Indiana's literary heritage. You think of James Whitcomb Riley and Kurt Vonnegut and Tarkington.
Sure.
But Rex Stout is right up there with the great writers. Most people would consider Rex Stout to be the king of mystery detectives and writing. So we can add Rex Stout now to our claim of Indiana literary heritage.
To be fair, he didn't live here very long.
That's true. He didn't. But I think, you know, once you're born here, you just kind of carry that that Hoosier connection with you for the rest of your life.
You know, it's funny. In many of his books, actually, there is often references to Indiana. And we were chatting before we went on that I'm, in fact, a big Rex Stout, big Nero Wolfe fan. And, in fact, this is a great time to be celebrating Rex Stout because his first book, the first Nero Wolfe book that he wrote, Fertile Lands, is actually having its 75th anniversary
right
now. And in fact, Stout wrote more than 70 Wolf tales, both novels and short stories, almost one a year from the 30s through the mid-70s, right up until the point when
he died. He was very productive, and he was always appreciated and very popular.
Well, and very
with critics and the readers.
Exactly. And you know, one thing that's a really interesting thing for mystery fans, if you're not familiar with the Nero Wolfe books, is that often mysteries are sort of, they fall into often one of two categories, the sort of the detective story or the cozy story. And the detective story is, you know, the guy who's out about, you know, walking around town solving the mystery, and the cozy, you know, sort of takes place in a small cozy area with a small cast of characters. And, you know, you think about, you know, the detective being a Philip Marlowe or a Sherlock Holmes, and the cozy being an Agatha Christie type of book. And what Rex Stout did was sort of successfully blend the two with
his
characters.
I hadn't thought about that, but you're so right. It's like getting two for the price of one.
Exactly. Right. You've got Archie Goodwin, who's
your man about
classic
town,
private
eye. And then you have, you know, Nero Wolfe is the genius, the detective that solves the mystery using logic and reason.
Sitting there in his great brownstone in New York.
In his brownstone.
So it's certainly a fun book to read, and I was so delighted that that Rex Stout was getting the sort of attention through One Book, One City by having his book One Buried Caesar selected, one of the fine mysteries in the Nero Wolfe collection. Tell me a bit about all the different activities, because there's in addition to it just being selected and the attention being given, and certainly there's lots of copies floating around. I know the library has many copies to loan out, but there's also lectures and activities and your website, all sort of ways of connecting to this.
Yes, certainly people are welcome to read the book, and if that is as far as they want to take it, that's fine. But there are opportunities to participate with your fellow residents in Indianapolis, and that really is one of the objectives of One Book, One City, is to stimulate discussion as a group. And so there's a couple ways you can do that. Some of the branches are offering your traditional book discussion groups, and that's great. You know, if you are able to come to a program at a certain time on a certain date, you can have that face-to-face kind of discussion with people in a room. But that often is difficult for people to find the time to do that. So we've come up with some other alternatives. If you still would like to participate in the actual space at the library, we've come up with something that we call Read It and Rate It comment cards. And so when you check out the book, you'll receive a comment card along with the book. And they're kind of fun little rating system that you can check off, and it's kind of related to the mystery theme. So, for example, one question is, would you recommend this book to a friend? And you can decide whether you want to rate it as yes, it's a killer, or probably I found it arresting, or probably not, I'd be gun-shy, or not over my dead body. So, but then also, you can also add your comments, write your comments in. And we have found that This is a lot of fun. The bookmark rating card stays with the book when it's turned back in, and then it is reshelved. So you kind of pass it forward to the next person who's browsing or checks the book out, and they can read the comments and kind of keep the discussion going. And people have found this to be a lot of fun, and it kind of helps you decide whether you want to recommend this book to a friend or you want to take it home for yourself. So that's one way of participating in the library, but there's also the virtual option, too, on our website, and there's different options to decide whether you want to discuss the book, or you can participate in the Read It and Rate It on the website as well. There's lots more information. There's a downloadable discussion guide that people really enjoy, because sometimes you need a little help in coming up with questions that will make your book discussion group more effective, more successful, kind of get things started. So we actually have an expert on Narrow Wolf, Jane Cleland, who is a member of the Wolf Pack, which is the society.
The Narrow Wolf Fan Club.
The Narrow Wolf Fan Club.
And also a mystery writer herself.
A very good mystery writer herself wrote the questions for the discussion guide. So it is expertly done, and I think if you'll check it out on our website, it will be, even if you just want to enjoy the book more on your own, you'll find the questions very provocative.
Certainly. And Jane is a very knowledgeable reader of the Narrow Wolf mysteries and brings a lot to it. I know that, in fact, I got to chat with her a bit, and that Some Buried Caesar is one of her favorite of the Narrow Wolf books. It's interesting because many people do list this as one of their favorite Narrow Wolf books. In fact, a number of years back, it was selected as one of the century's 100 favorite mysteries by the Independent Mystery Booksellers Association, which is quite an achievement. And it is a really fun mystery, and it's, I believe, maybe the sixth or so in the Nero Wolf series, and it starts out with sort of a very humorous opening scene, and it introduces the character of Lily Rowan, who comes back in many of the other books. The Caesar that's referred to is a big bull, but, I always find it interesting that this one is so revered by so many people because it's, in fact, very different from a lot of the other Nero Wolf books. Most of the Nero Wolf books take place in that brownstone we mentioned on 35th Street in New York City, where this one actually takes place almost entirely all in upstate New York. It takes up outside of the house.
It kind of forces Nero Wolf into many situations that he finds uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So, and it turns out to be more amusing for Archie Goodwin to make comments about. And he is always very witty in his dialogue anyway. So that, I think, I was one of the features that I enjoyed the most about this particular book.
Yeah, that's a good point, because a lot of the fun of this book comes from sort of knowing what to expect or what, does make Nero Wolf comfortable or uncomfortable. And that would probably be the only thing that I would say, Melanie, as far as, why this one maybe wouldn't always be the best choice for if it was going to be your first Nero Wolf book.
That's true. It's not typical of most of his books and the setting that you would find him in.
I was thinking about this earlier, like, well, what would be a good one? And there's so many, great ones, whether you start with the first one, Fertile Lance, or some of the later ones like Golden Spider or The Doorbell Rang, or maybe Murder by the Book. They're a little bit more typical of the genre. But still, at the same time, I mean, this is certainly one that, even though it is part of a series, you don't have to at all have read any of the others to be able to pick it up and really enjoy
it. I don't know whether this is true or not. Maybe you can tell me, but in one source I read that it was Rex Stout's favorite book of his.
I've heard that as well.
So,
I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it's certainly a good mystery and a very fun read.
And it happened to be the selection by BoucherCon for their One Book, One Conference.
Right. They chose it as well, which was great to have all these mystery writers talking about it. In fact, there was even sort of a dinner that was partially organized around it. And it's certainly a great introduction to the Nero Wolf series if you've never read them. And many people, maybe their first introduction was through one of the different TV shows. There was the A&E series. It was a lot of fun a couple years back.
Those are great. But I think the books are even better, because you might wonder why we would choose a mystery to be the selection for One Book, One City. But I think that what makes a book good for discussion purposes is what the author doesn't tell you, mm-hmm. because that's what you want to talk about and think about. And I think Rex Stout did such a great job of laying clues between the lines to make you think about the mystery and want to try to solve it and want to talk about it with other people. You know, Jane Cleland asked in her book discussion guide, when did you think you knew?
Mm-hmm. Who, always a great question.
Yes, yeah. Who committed the crime? And I will have to admit, I did not know until mm-hmm. the very end.
Well, you know, and one other thing about Rex Stout's books, in addition to the great mystery, it's very intelligent writing. I mean, they're some of the few mysteries that you actually need to sit there with a dictionary by your side often while you're reading them.
Yes, his vocabulary mm-hmm. is really something else.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. I guess Rex Stout actually was a spelling bee champion in many states. He also had a pretty mm-hmm. amazing career. I mean, he mm-hmm. worked for Teddy Roosevelt. He was like the first mate or something on Teddy Roosevelt's yacht, and then had a career where he made a fortune with an accounting system for public schools, and then was able to sort of go off and write his books. And I
think there was a little bit of Narrow Wolf and Rex Stout. And I read in another source that they felt that he brought scholarship to mystery writing.
I think that's a great way to put it. And another great reason why we should be reading Rex Stout and celebrating him, especially his Indiana connections. The IMCPL website, there's actually a place on there where people can go
yes.
and find out more information about how to participate.
There are pages dedicated to One Book, One City, and you can find out more about Rex Stout. You can find out more about the book. There are several places that you can participate or leave your comments about the book itself or about One Book, One City. So there's lots of different ways to join in and find out more. And hopefully you'll be inspired to read more in the series.
Absolutely. Do you have a favorite yourself, Melanie? Or?
This is my first Rex. I love mysteries, but I'm more of the procedural mm-hmm. and the Patricia Cornwell kind of books. And these are very different because he doesn't really use, you don't go into the crime scene laboratory to solve these mysteries. It's all solved in the old-fashioned way
yes.
through someone's intelligence and wit. And but I
very
found
little
it,
blood.
Yes.
Almost none.
Not a lot of action, but the action is all in his mind and in Archie Goodwin's Man About Town mm-hmm. Doing all the heavy lifting for Narrow Wolf. But I found it just as compelling and intriguing to read and thought-provoking as well.
Travis DiNicola with Melanie Whistle, a program manager from the IMCPL. The One Book, One City selection this year is Rex Stout's Some Buried Caesar, which is available at all library branches. For more information about related activities, visit imcpl.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. I'll find out what's going on with the Percussive Arts Society.
And you won't miss a beat. I'll get a preview of the ANCATS Festival of Books at the JCC.
And I'll take a look at the annual Tonic Bowl, or maybe a sip of that. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.